Time is 9:06. It is the 21st of February. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Present for the record are Senators Bundy, Green, Stevens, and myself, McGuire. We have three items on the agenda today, and the first we will take up is Senate Bill number 232, National Guard Command Active Service Pay by the Governor. Next is House Bill 15, Board of Fisheries Conflict of Interest, Representative Seaton. House Bill 260, State Officers Compensation Commission, Representative Dugan. So first up, Senate Bill 232. McHugh, welcome to Senate State Affairs and good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is McHugh Pierre. I'm the Legislative Liaison for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. SB 232 really came to light in 2004 when there was the extreme wildfires in the interior. We had Alaska National Guardsmen fighting that wildfire alongside Division of Forestry and also BLM wildfire fighters. There's two different pay rates that we've discovered based on this fire. There's the emergency firefighter pay rate, and then when we activate the National Guard, it's a state active duty pay rate. The Guard members who were fighting right alongside the wildfire, professional wildfire fighters, if you will, were discussing pay with them, and they discovered that they were making at least half, no more than half of what the other firefighters were making, to as low as one-fourth of what the other firefighters were making. So when my commissioner, General Campbell, brought this up to Commissioner Tom Irwin, Commissioner Irwin said, well, heck, we've got the money, let's just pay him. Well, as it turns out, the statute doesn't allow that. We have to pay National Guard members state active duty rates when they are activated, regardless of what the situation is. So in Section 2, that will make that change. Section 1 of this bill will allow a little more freedom for when there are other events in the governor's, when the governor's not as available to be reached, she may delegate authority to the commissioner of our department, who's also the adjutant general of the Alaska National Guard, and he would be able to activate National Guard forces for whatever issue the governor has delegated to him prior to the situation. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, McHugh. So just to be a little bit of devil's advocate, how do we know that changing the statute here to reflect the one circumstance that you discussed where there was a clear disparity won't simply lead to a whole scale change in the rate overall? And if it is going to, should we just take that head on and look at what that budget figure would be?
Madam Chair, thank you very much for that question. Actually, this only addresses wildfire fighting, and it's structured by the professional wildfire fighters, such as DNR, BLM. They set the rates, and it's only when our guys go into action at the call of the BLM and the DNR folks. This happens every summer, and our folks definitely understand that this is not the norm. But it's an exception for wildfire fighting because it is such a dangerous task in the state.
Okay. All right. Question, Senator Green.
Okay. I assume that other firefighters go through professional training and are classified as firefighters, maybe at different degrees. Does the National Guard have that kind of training available to its members?
They do go through specific training to their job. And I also have Lynn Wilcock here from the Division of Forestry and Chris Mage, who's the director of the division online, who might be able to speak to this as well. But they're only called for specific duties on the fire line. So when Division of Forestry says we need a helicopter and we need some pilots, then our guys go in and fill that role. They don't go and fill roles that they're not capable of doing. So if there's a a crew chief position and our guys need to go and fill that with our equipment, that's how they're utilized. Otherwise, they're not utilized to fight the fire.
So it's very, specific. It's not 50 guys are going to go out and be tromping through the forest next to the other firefighters.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Green, that's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Having served for 3 years as an Army officer, one of the things I learned is that you don't have a choice when you're in the military. There is a difference. I mean, firefighters can choose not to go, I assume, but the military can't if they are assigned. That's an order and obligation. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that is true. However, we are the last line of defense, if you will. So the Division of Forestry calls out the private contractors, Evergreen, other people who are involved, and then they call us and say, hey, we need you for these specific jobs. And our leadership determines what specific job they will do. They send them to the fire knowing that there's only one position that they're qualified for, and that's the position they fill.
And I'm sure, just for full disclosure, are there benefits? I appreciate your comment about equal pay for equal work. That's sound. Everyone can agree to that, I think. But are there benefits then that the military would have that others don't, because they are members of the military? I think in terms of retirement, use of the PX or whatever. I mean, there must be some benefits there, right?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, there are the benefits of being a National Guard member. However, through this legislation, they'll be treated just like any other wildfire fighter on the scene. They'll be treated the same way when it comes to workers' compensation. They'll be treated the same way when it comes to medical benefits. When they're off of this fire, then they'll be treated just like they were in the National Guard again.
Thank you, Mr.
Okay, and Senator French has joined us. Senator Green.
Yeah, you mentioned the equipment. Does the department get compensated for the equipment that goes for the fire?
For the record, I'm Lynn Wilcock, the Chief of Fire and Aviation for the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Forestry. Through the chair, Senator Green, they do get compensated basically for their costs of flying the aircraft. And that's primarily what we're talking about here is the National Guard Blackhawks and making sure that the pilots and the support personnel that support those helicopters receive equal pay. As mentioned, this was something that Commissioner Irwin recognized in 2004 when they were getting paid significantly less, and they have proven to be an extremely valuable asset. I do want to point out again that these are National Guard assets that we only use once we've used all of the civilian assets that are available in the state. We have to order additional assets from the lower 48, and the National Guard is extremely valuable in providing that service in that interim time when we're waiting for those resources to arrive.
No, I was just curious on, because we were just going over the DNR budget, and it's always amazing to read and see the figures of the set-aside cost and then tack on the per-hour cost. And I just wanted to be sure DNVA was getting a few bucks for their rental.
Through the chair, Senator Green, that's very true. Aviation assets are getting expensive. We do make sure that the Guard gets paid for their cost of using those assets.
Thank you. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. The 35-something an hour that you're proposing, that's what a state employee who was a helicopter pilot would be paid. That's bringing those wages up comparable. Is this what I understand the bill doing?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that's correct. We set our emergency firefighter rates based on the federal government rate for similar jobs, adjusted for inflation each year, and that is the comparable rate for a pilot if we were to hire that person as a pilot for the state of Alaska.
And I think is it accurate then, and I haven't been a commercial pilot in a while, but when you employ a private asset, the helicopter pilot is flying for ERA or someone like that is making a good bit more than $35 an hour.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that to be quite honest, I'm not sure. That rate is established by the company that employs the pilot. We pay availability and flight rate for the helicopter to the company. The company establishes the rate for their pilots. I expect it's in that range, but probably you're right. It's probably more than 35 an hour, but it depends on the company.
I mean, fixed wings are making $60 an hour 15 years ago, so helicopter pilots are making more than that in the private sector. I just indexing this $35 an hour, and I'm not suggesting state employees get a raise, but $35 an hour compared to the private assets is probably low.
Yeah. Okay, any further questions for Mr. Wilcox or Mr. Pierre? Senator Stevens.
I'm not sure I know the answer to this, but the primary responsibility of the National Guard is a military one, and so should they be involved in the firefighting and something should occur in which their service is needed elsewhere, that would be the priority, right?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that's correct. As soon as there's a priority that takes precedent over the wildfire, they will be removed from the wildfire.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. And we have one other person, Chris Meisch. Is that right? Meisch, with DNR Division of Forestry. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, I am, Madam Chair.
Good morning. If you want to put yourself on the record and offer testimony.
Yes, my name is Chris Meisch. I am the Director of the Division of Forestry and State Forester. And this morning, I would speak on behalf of Commissioner Irwin, who's traveling this morning and not able to personally attend this hearing. But he did want me to emphasize on his behalf that he's a very strong supporter and very enthusiastic about this legislative change. And as one of the members of the committee mentioned earlier, he's very supportive of equal pay for equal type of work. And I don't believe I can add a lot to what you've already heard this morning from the other two gentlemen testifying, so I'll keep this short, but the commissioner did want to add his strong support for moving this along.
Thank you very much. Questions? Okay, hearing and seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Anyone else here in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 232? Anybody online I've overlooked? Okay, and so public testimony is closed. That brings Senate Bill 232 back before us for committee discussion or a motion. Senator Bundy.
I'd just like to put on the record the comment that there's any number of Alaskans that move back off the end of the road claiming they get no state services and should then, of course, never pay any fees for the services they don't get. But if you look at the cost of fighting those fires in remote areas, they get a substantial state service if and when a tragedy strikes.
That's a good point. Anything further? Motion, Senator Stevens?
Madam Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 232 out of committee with the attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there an objection to that motion? Okay, hearing and seeing none, Senate Bill 232 has passed out of Senate State Affairs. That brings us to House Bill 15. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And thank you to the men and women that serve us. House Bill 15, Senator, Representative Seaton. This is a Freudian slip from yesterday in Judiciary. Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. Appreciate the hearing on House Bill 15. House Bill 15 expands the ability of the Board of Fish to accomplish the job we want them to do by allowing the members to bring their expertise for which they're appointed to the Board of Fish discussions. Current law requires Board of Fish members to declare a conflict of interest and recuse themselves from discussion and voting if they or a member of their family have a personal or financial interest on the matter before the board. This requirement prevents commercial fishermen and charter boat guide fishermen from being able to bring the expertise for actually what they were often appointed to the board to the table on those issues. The Board of Fish is composed of seven members appointed to bring that expertise and their detailed knowledge to that board. On average, between 2001 and 2006, during the board cycles, 10% of the proposals had some member have to recuse themselves so that that expertise was not able to be offered during discussion or voting. The current law disproportionately affects rural Alaska. Fishing in rural Alaska, a good example would be Bristol Bay, is the main source of the economy there. And so, as you would expect, anybody that's been a long-term resident in that area has numerous family members throughout the entire area that are involved in the economic base of the entire area, which generally revolves around some commercial fishing participation. Fishing. Under the current definition that is being used, immediate family under 3952-960 includes the parents, the siblings, the grandparents, the aunts, and the uncles. So this expansive definition means that if you're living in Togiak and have a relative in Dillingham that has a commercial fishing license or a sport guide license, you have to recuse yourself and not discuss the issues or participate in the voting on those issues. So this amendment, an amendment was unanimously adopted on the other side, which changed that definition to the same definition that we use for the legislature. That is the definition of family. It'd be the immediate family, anyone, you know, a spouse, domestic partner, any child living with you or any parents or anyone that's dependent upon you. And so that is a significant change, but it's meant to bring the expertise and conflicts to real conflicts, those within the immediate family, not that extended family. The House Bill 15 also has a sunset in 2011, requires a report so that we will be able to see whether the adoption of this has had the desired effect of preventing these numerous recusals that are extraordinary, but that we still have an effective system of not having financial or conflict of interest voted or discussed on the board. So those are the broad parameters. You have included in your packet a comparison of family definitions under the two statutes, the first one under what it currently is, and then the legislative definition that this bill would change it to. And you also have a list from 2003 to 2006 of all of the 122 boards and how many recusals there have been. And you can see that in most of the boards, there's been absolutely no recusals. There's been a few that have had one, and yet you have 103 regulatory proposals in which you had it just in 2006 where you had that affecting that many proposals. In the previous year, in 2005, the Board of Fish had 7 recusals on 41 proposals. So the intent of this is to make sure that we bring the board's expertise to the, for which those people are appointed, to the issues at hand, a good explanation that we had of how this works differently, like the medical board. We have the medical board in which they're appointed, and they, we had the medical board, the executive director on the phone with us, and they've not had any recusals ever. And there was one time in which they had a proposal up that would regulate a physician from having a dispensary, basically a pharmacy in their office. And one person took themselves off. There was no determination that was a conflict. But we have, you know, this is what the board is to do. They get in and they talk about medical regulations or surgery, and a surgeon will vote on those, whether he or his wife practices surgery and all. So that is being applied so differently in the other boards than it is on the Board of Fish. And part of that distinction has been on this determination of the broad aspect or broad inclusion. And it's generally determined that if the permit is a statewide permit, and that's why this does not deal with the Board of Game, because anybody having a sport fish license, a hunting license, fishes statewide or hunts statewide. And so the determination is that that license is broadly held by everybody, and so there's not a conflict. When you come to charter vessel licenses sometimes, or commercial fishing licenses, they're for an area. So like Bristol Bay, you may have 1,400 people have permits, but the determination has been it's not the entire state, so therefore it's not this wide group, even though there's 1,400 people, and you have the same, that board member may have the same exact relation as everybody else, but it's not the entire state. So the board of the AGs for the Board of Fisheries has determined this very narrowly, that that's one of the reasons there are so many recusals, and this takes care of some of that aspect.
Okay, questions for Representative Seaton at this time? Okay, seeing none at this time, we do have some folks to testify. Thank you, Representative Seaton. The first is Clem Tillion. Clem, are you there?
I am.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hello. I'm testifying in favor of this. I don't like the sunset. And if anything, this is tighter than I'd make it. But this is a step in the right direction. When I was in charge of appointing people on the board, under Walter Hickel. For instance, I put Dickie Jacobson of Sandpoint and Trefon Anguson of Naknek on so that I'd have people on both sides of the Area M fight. Well, they became great friends because they both sat in the hallway, unable to testify, and they were the only ones that knew anything about it. What I found is twice now I've had proposals before the board that everybody was in favor of, but having a missing board member that wasn't at the meeting made it impossible for me to get the four votes necessary to do anything. The board was paralyzed, even though they were unanimous in their willingness to do it. It's just that we had people that were had to recuse themselves or taken out. And what I'm saying is that what we did in the legislature is the right way to do it. Because often a person will actually not want to vote on the issue and will stretch it a little bit to recuse themselves so they don't have to be recorded. But to me, that's a no vote. So even though their constituents want them to vote yes, you ended up with them voting no because that was recusal is no. Please pass this. It's a step in the right direction. And for those of us that appear before the board quite frequently, it's a very needed correction.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tillian. Questions for Mr. Tillian? Okay, next on the line, we have, it says Ricky Geese and one other.
Geese. My name is Ricky Geese from, I'm the executive director at Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a couple of comments. I do support certain parts of this bill. I like the idea of redefining immediate family. I think oftentimes the extended family concept, especially in smaller communities, unnecessarily recuses people. And I think that one redefinition of redefining where a conflict is will help limit the number of recusals that you'll see in the Board of Fisheries. I also think on page 2, line 14, there needs to be some discussion of the word substantial. What does substantial financial interest mean? Is it a set dollar amount? Is it $2,000, $5,000, or is it a percentage of a person's income and or some combination of that? I think that you have to be careful, though, on some other parts of this bill where we allow a person with a financial interest or a conflict of interest to participate in the deliberations. I think as a lay board, the Board of Fisheries gets information from the public through public testimony and committee work. And I think currently there are always various user groups arguing over proposals, and there's some very significant allocative changes that can be made through the Board of Fisheries process that has financial implications for those various user groups. I think by allowing a member to deliberate on issues and that member has a financial interest, even though we're talking about the expertise, it's an expertise representing one user group, and there are going to be other user groups at that Board of Fisheries. And I think it gives that user group, the perception can be that it gives that user group an unfair advantage in deliberations, because when the board goes into deliberations, you will now have a spokesperson from your user group potentially on the Board of Fisheries interacting with the department, whereas other user groups may be left out, and they think they may get some unfair advantage asking certain questions to the department. Whereas if other board members were asking those questions, it might not seem as unfair as that. So I think if this bill is passed with the ability for a person with a financial interest to deliberate, your board of fish appointment process is going to be become much more political, because there's more than seven different user groups across the whole state, and everybody's going to try and say, well, I want my stake on the board, even though we may have a financial interest conflict. At least I'll be able to be up there in deliberations and ask certain questions, and I think that's going to put much more pressure on the legislature and the governor when they do make appointments to the Board of Fisheries. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Geese. Questions or comments? Senator Green.
When he refers to deliberating, is there like us, like we go through an introduction and testimony and everything, is the deliberation a very clear line? You talk about it and hear about it first and receive testimony, then go into deliberation?
Senator Green, through the chair, usually, let's see, for example, at the Upper Cook Inlet meeting here, the board will receive department reports and any other information, public information that's presented through the department. Then you will have public testimony, 3 minutes to 5 minutes on public testimony, depending on how many people are there. And then proposals will be clumped together in committees, and usually 2 to 3 board members will lead a committee through all the different proposals within their committee. Then they'll go back and give a talk and a report on where the public was on that. And then the board goes into deliberations, and they go proposal by proposal. And it is important about what questions get asked, and they go through that deliberative process with the department, but the public then from that point on is excluded. So you may have different user groups that would want to have certain questions asked, and if you have a person who's not voting but is in the position of asking certain questions of the department or can kind of slant issues one way or the other, that can be perceived by the other user group who may not have their interest up on the board as being an unfair advantage.
Senator Green. Are you saying there's a point to which you think it's okay for a conflicted member to participate in everything down to deliberations, and then they should recuse and not either deliberate or vote?
Yes, that's what currently it is now. If you're recused on a proposal, you basically become another voice within the member of the public, and you can participate as any other member of the public does, providing information to the Board of Fisheries, the other members of the Board of Fisheries, through public testimony and or through the committee process. And you, and as a board member, of course, you're talking to your other board members about issues, and there's so there may not be time necessarily on the record, quote, for the expertise to be put through the deliberative process, but you can share your expertise just like other members of the public can. But once you get into the deliberative mode, that's where certain questions asked of the department or of other board members may become, could be perceived to be an unfair advantage of different from a user group's perspective.
Okay, so the part of this legislation that you like is the redefinition of the immediate family member?
That's correct, and I think that will reduce the number of recusals that board members will have to make. And but if there is a direct financial conflict of interest, I think it would be unfair to have somebody deliberate on a proposal and then kind of just say we're going to recuse yourself from the vote, because that gives an unfair advantage to that person and the user group that they're involved with. And usually proposals are allocative changes between user groups, whether it's commercial to commercial set versus drift, or, you know, in Upper Cook Inlet, there's a variety of user groups, personal use, guided sport fishing, commercial set, drift, you know, so you'll have a lot of interest from all the different user groups across the state. Wanting to get a person from their user group on the board so they could have that advantage in the deliberative process.
May I ask one more question?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now clarify something for me. From the time you receive the department reports and they report on information they have and the public testimony and the proposals and you ferret them out to the various committees and they come back, is every member able to freely talk and contribute regardless of conflict?
Yes. Okay. Up until the point where the board officially takes up a proposal, every member of the board is allowed to provide public input. If they're recused from something, they can provide public testimony just like any other member of the public. So if a board member has a financial interest in a specific proposal, they have the rights of any other member of the public to participate, just like any other member of the public who may have a financial interest in a proposal.
So generally, if I may,
yeah.
So generally, any member who is there and anticipates what's coming back from them, the proposals, can make their information, can share all their information at that time before the deliberations.
Senator Green, through the chair, yes, that is correct. And usually the proposals will, the deadline for proposals is usually anywhere from 8 months to 12 months ahead of time. And board members will see that, and department comments will be out usually about a month ahead of the time. And so when they're preparing for that Board of Fisheries meeting, they will have a pretty much of a clear idea where there will be conflicts of interest, financial conflicts of interest, and they have plenty of opportunity to provide their expertise and input into a proposal if they're conflicted out, just like any other member of the public would.
Okay. I've not been to a Board of Fish meeting for 100 years. Tell me, does the group or the board ever return or go back from deliberations to open discussion? Because very often in the legislature, we close public testimony and then we go back after an amendment or something or a suggestion and then take public input. Does that ever happen in the Board of Fish?
Senator Green, through the chair, no, that really doesn't happen at the Board of Fish. At that point, once the deliberative process starts, public input is pretty much limited unless a proposal was tabled for further consideration. Then the public may have the ability to submit an RC, a record copy of comments on something, but there are very few tabled proposals that gets taken up later. So once a proposal is taken up and the board is deliberating, they will work through that proposal and then move on to the next proposal. So the public does not have chance to provide comment. Once the department, and there may be amendments to proposals that are board generated, and that's part of the deliberative process.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for your testimony. Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Could you comment, Ricky, on the issue of we've heard that sometimes the board is so conflicted that there's not enough votes left to take action. Have you experienced that at all?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, I have seen a couple times where a couple board members may be conflicted out on an issue or a proposal, and you may have five board members there voting on something. But then again, if there's a lot of times that the board will vote 7-0 or 6-0 on a proposal, and typically where you come down to 4-3 decisions or 4-2 decisions are on decisions that are very allocative and might make some major swings in depending on which based on financial advantages that may be gained through the passage or non-passage of a proposal. So if a proposal really makes sense, they'll typically pass, 6-0 or 7-0. So I think you would, in our attempt to provide ethical and clean government, I think you would run into some problems if, this bill would not, you'd still get in that position where you're not allowing somebody with a financial conflict of interest to vote. So that's not going to change. What you're allowing this bill would allow to do is to allow somebody to deliberate when other members of the public with that same financial vested interest would not be able to deliberate once the deliberations get going.
Okay, further questions? Okay, next up we have Jerry McCune.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
How are you this morning, committee? My name is Jerry McCune. I represent Nine Fishermen Alaska, the largest statewide commercial fishing group. We support the bill as written. We've been working on this bill has been around for 10 years, and we worked with a lot of parties trying to make compromises in this bill, and one was taking the vote out of there so you couldn't vote. I think it swings both ways. conflict of interest could be a lodge owner, could be a commercial, could be some financial interest in a processing plant. So it swings both ways. I mean that if you're the party that your person's conflicted out, you don't like that too well. But in the other party over here, they're going, oh, great, that guy's conflicted out. So it swings both ways. I mean, you know, people sometimes bring it to the table just to try to conflict people out, you know, and the chairman has to make that determination. But in this particular board, there's only seven people, and it's not just about Cook Inlet. I mean, these board meetings are all around the state. I mean, from Southeast to Kodiak to Cordova to, you know, crab fishing. So there's many times that we've had crab experts on this board, which is a unique fishery in itself in the Bering Sea, and those guys were conflicted out because they either crewed or they own a vessel or they couldn't say anything. You have to go sit in the audience and sit there. So if a question comes up, nobody knows it. If the department doesn't know it, they can't be answered. So we feel that if everybody can deliberate, that's great. There's no voting. You can't. You don't get the final say in it. The board itself gets to make that decision, but you don't get to take part in that. So I think it's a very good compromise, and also the section that that lets only immediate family makes sense. You know, I could have a second cousin out in Bristol Bay. I don't even like that guy, and I'd be conflicted out. Don't even know him. So I think that's very good. But I think the bill overall has been a real battle between a lot of groups to try to compromise, and so we support the bill as written. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McCune. Questions? Okay, thank you. Okay, the last person we have to testify is Bruce Wrigley with the Farm Bureau. And Bryce came by Mr. Wrigley to talk about the idea of putting in the Board of Agriculture and Conservation into House Bill 15 as a concept. So, Mr. Wrigley, you want to talk about that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We in the Farm Bureau believe that when an individual is appointed to represent a geographical area or a sector of the industry, as in the case of agriculture, that they need to be allowed to participate in the discussions relating to that representation. And if there's a potential conflict of interest, then, of course, it's the member's duty to inform the chair before debate starts so that the chair can rule on the ability to vote. But it's important that they participate in the discussion. As soon as we got wind of this bill, HB 15, we realized that it addressed a similar problem that we have experienced with respect to the Board of Agriculture and Conservation. In the past, and even currently, when farmers are seated on the Board of Agriculture and Conservation, they have been prevented from even participating in the discussion. And I don't understand this policy. It makes me wonder why there is even a board if a member can only discuss those things that they don't know anything about. How is a board expected to arrive at any kind of an intelligent decision when they operate under such a policy? In the proposed amendment, which, and I'm not sure the proper order of things, we would like to propose that an amendment be offered and Madam Chair, you have that amendment, I believe, before you. We seek to clarify that the Board of Agriculture and Conservation must also allow their members to discuss the areas of expertise and to represent the people that they've been seated to represent, although they may not vote when the conflict of interest is possible.
Shall we have the amendment?
My understanding is that almost all the legislators and staff members, when we were in Juneau last week, we spoke to, agreed that this was sound reasoning. It was similar to what they already do, to what you already do in your own legislative committees. We sought support from Representative Seaton for the amendment because it was his bill. We sought support from you, Madam Chair, and also we spoke with Senator Huggins' office from Senate Resources, Senator Stedman's office of Finance, great, and asked them to support the bill as well. And everyone understood what we're saying. Everybody agreed that made sense.
Thank you, Mr. Wrigley. Okay, we'll have a motion for the amendment. Senator Green.
Madam Chair, I'll move what I think is amendment number one.
That's correct.
And it's K2.
Okay, is there an objection to amendment number one? Yes, Senator Stevens.
It's just an objection. I'd like to hear from Representative Seaton, his response.
I'll offer it for discussion.
Great. Senator Representative Seaton, would you like to comment on amendment number one?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The information that I have is that the Board of Agriculture has the same kind of a problem that exists, and I don't have an objection to putting this in. I would like to relate that there is a difference in these. The in the current bill, this allows for discussion, and if you have a participatory interest that is based on a sport fishing guide license or a commercial fishing license, and does not allow a lobbyist. If you have a lobbying interest, if somebody is hiring you, if you are executive director of an organization who's paid to be there at the Board of Fish or on the Board of Fish, so there is this distinction in the current bill that says if you have a conflict based on participation in the fisheries, then you can discuss. If you are actually hired by someone, let's say you are a lobbyist and you happen to be on the Board of Fish and there is a action that's before you, you would not be able to participate in that deliberation, because this is not there's quite a difference between a participatory conflict that you have by participating in the industry or whether you are hired and representing someone else to be on the board. In one aspect, you have kind of a moral conflict because you are there as a participant in the industry. If there is an allocation issue or something, you know, that would be money in your pocket. If you're there as a lobbyist or you happen to be a lobbyist, then you have no conflict at all because you would be serving your the people that had hired you as well as serving on the issue. So there is, I just want to point it out, that on page 2, that if this part of these negotiations is how far does this conflict of interest go, and you'll see on line 3, or line 2 and 3, so that the on the Board of Fisheries or a member's immediate family conducted under a permit or license issued under 1605, which is commercial fisheries, or 1640-270, which is a sport fishing guide license parameters. So I just wanted to point that out. I don't see anything in this amendment that changes that. This was a delicate balance to make sure that we didn't have the situation where we've heard about everybody wanting to have their executive director on the Board of Fish so that they could bring home the bacon. So this bill does not open up that possibility of having hired lobbyists on the board and deliberating or voting on issues.
Okay, the only thing I'm confused about, Representative Seaton, is how does that have to do with the amendment?
I just wanted to clarify that this amendment has a little different language. It only applies to the Board of Agriculture, and I just wanted to make sure as this amendment got rolled in, there wasn't a inadvertent inclusion of different language, because that language has been crafted very carefully to make sure that these were based on participation as a guide and not as hired by a group of guides or hired by a group of commercial fishermen to be on the Board of Fish.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and set the bill aside anyway until next week. So why don't we go ahead and keep the matter of amendment number 1 sitting here before us, and let's get an opinion on that, and that'll give us some time to be sure that it reconciles what your wishes are. Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question. Bringing the Board of Agriculture into the sort of sphere of this bill makes me ask, how many boards are there that have this arrangement? You know, are there 5? Are there 20? Is this something we should be doing for all the boards? I'm throwing that out there. Maybe the sponsor can find out, or if there's someone from the boards and commissions that can tell us from the administration. But I'm just wondering how widespread the problem.
That's something you could be prepared to tell us at the next hearing.
I sure can.
Okay, thank you.
We have Bryce Wrigley on.
Yes,
can I ask him?
Senator Green.
Yeah, Bryce, could you clarify something for me? I'm talking to the man who goes to the Board of Fish meetings a while ago. I wanted to know, does the Board of Agriculture and Conservation have a similar process for reviewing and getting information and list of proposals and all that
and then go into deliberation?
I was actually quite surprised. Oh, excuse me, Senator Green, through the chair. I was actually quite surprised at the idea that the Board of Fisheries actually knew what was coming up 10 months to 12 months ahead of time.
Right.
That is not the case with the Board of Agriculture, and I don't know that how realistic that is to expect that from any board. In your own body, as you know, you craft legislation, and there are changes that come up that that require immediate comments or participation. So with the Board of Agriculture and Conservation, there is public comment. It happens at the beginning of the board meeting, and then once the deliberative process starts, then obviously there are other questions that come up, and in the course of discussion that if someone is recused and cannot answer, then there's no good information that is available for the board to make a reasonable decision on. And that's the concern. If there was some way of going into the deliberative mode and then coming out and discussing those things and then making final decision, that might address that. But it makes it pretty problematic in the Board of Agriculture and Conservation. Those meetings sometimes last all day, and obviously someone can't be on the line waiting for the possibility that they will need to be speaking again. I think that the proper way to address this is what the bill does. It allows discussion from those that have been appointed to represent an area or a sector. It allows the treatment of the issues once public comment is closed, and yet it recuses or it allows a person to be recused from voting or prevented from voting once there is, or when there is a conflict of interest established.
Okay, but I guess my question is, does the public have the opportunity to weigh back in after the deliberations begin?
No.
Okay. I have one more question.
Senator Green.
Who is the person on the Board of Agriculture from your area?
I don't believe that there is one from my area now.
Is there one from Fairbanks?
Not that I know of.
Is there one from Toke?
No.
Barrow?
Homer? No. What?
Homer?
No. What the problem is, obviously it would be, as far as the farming interests would be restricted to those, the farming seats would be restricted to those that have an interest in farming. Mm-hmm. But, for example, in the past we have had representatives from, for example, Kodiak and Homer, when the deliberations included something about Mount McKinley Meats plant, they were prevented from discussing it, and yet they were the only ones on the board who knew anything about meat. Similar process with a dairy or a grain farm, anything like that. If you have an interest in a certain sector, you're prevented from discussing on that sector, and so consequently the only thing you're allowed to testify to or vote or discuss are those things that you don't have any knowledge about.
Well, I just wanted to be sure that no one was thinking that there's statewide participation on the Board of Agriculture at this particular time. My district, however, is well represented. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Wrigley. Okay, we're going to go ahead and set House Bill 15 aside. Thank you, Representative Seaton. And we're going to go to House Bill 260.
Madam Chair, could I just
let
you know that we had one technical amendment to put in because there's been a change, and so I'll forward that. It's just statutory reference.
Okay, great. Thank you. House Bill 260, Representative Dugan. Welcome to Senate State Affairs, and good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. Thanks for hearing this bill. For the record, I'm Mike Dugan. I represent House District 25, or maybe I should say in this venue, one half of Senate District M. and
the
I don't
better half?
It's a good half.
Okay. And I don't believe that Spinard has any representatives on the Ag Council.
Right now. None that'll step forward and be recognized.
They do have wildlife there, though, don't they?
They do indeed, Senator. House Bill 260 is an attempt to reestablish a compensation commission for the principal officers of the state of Alaska. There was last a working compensation commission, which I believe was called the Salary and Emoluments Commission back then, in 1977 to 79. And Senator Elton, who I believe can speak to this, was actually a public member on that commission, and he can tell you a little bit about how it worked and what happened to it. There was an attempt to reestablish a similar commission in 1986, but it was dependent upon passage of a constitutional amendment that never passed. And so you'll see some repealing language in this bill that refers to repealing that commission, which is still on the books and is not active. The bill would establish a commission of five members, three public members, all appointed by the governor, one appointed from a list presented by the president of the Senate, one appointed by a list presented by the Speaker of the House, and no member of the commission can have served in one of the offices, the compensation of which is under consideration in the previous 4 years. It would be staffed by the Department of Administration, and I believe that there's a fiscal note in your packet for about $7,500 for the estimated cost of that staffing. The commission would be required to report at least every 2 years. A report could be as simple as saying that no change is needed. The recommendations would take effect unless specifically rejected by the legislature, a provision that's now used, I believe, with the Local Boundary Commission and was suggested by the governor in her first draft of the AGEA bill. It would require an appropriation to fund. So essentially the legislature would get two looks at this provision. Those are the main points. Just like to add that the idea of a salary commission is not peculiar to Alaska. There are about 20 of them in the United States that are active right now. And I believe we have a gentleman named Carl Kurtz from the National Council of State Legislators online who can either answer questions or I think is prepared to make a presentation on the subject. And with that, I'll just belt up and see if there are any questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dugan. Senator Bundy.
Thank you. This would not be like U.S. Congress where if we fail to vote no, then the raise is automatic because of the appropriation.
Because of the appropriation, no, it would not be automatic.
Okay. If we fail to vote no.
Madam Chair, as I understand how the congressional thing goes, there's a report that shows up that says you deserve a raise, and unless they take an affirmative action to deny that report, they get the raise.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of a...
like an executive order.
Letting it come in behind... It wasn't my fault. I didn't... Someone else, the devil made me take this money.
And I think you have the overt rejection, but then there's the appropriation requirement. In fact, the only thing I've ever thought about is it could end up being, Senator Elton is happy about this, but for the folks that wanted the capital to move at one point, the Frank Initiative and other things, in fact, my understanding is, in the early day, it ended up being the lack of appropriation that ended up not solidifying parts of that. So the one thing I have thought of in my mind is that if it truly is your intent to have an effective system of compensating lawmakers based on the recommendations of this commission and their thoughtful work, I have wondered whether having the step of appropriating it might be the death of it.
Madam Chair, it very well could be. I couldn't find a way to remove the legislature's power of appropriation from this process.
Just go upstairs. You'll get some ideas.
Yeah. Well, if I were sitting in that office on the third floor, I might have some ideas of my own, but I'm not. The legislature does have to appropriate the money. And there's no way around that. I have otherwise tried to remove the legislature as far as possible from this process because I truly believe that the only way we're going to get sort of rational decision-making here is if we have citizens involved who don't have anything on the table either one way or the other.
That's right. Okay, further questions, Senator Bundy?
Along that line of thought, I think to get truly citizen participation, the appropriation would have to be funded out of the earnings reserve of the permanent fund.
Okay, we'll look forward to that amendment. All right. Thank you, Representative Bundy. Senator.
Representative Bundy,
pardon me, Senator Bundy.
Ooh, you got demoted.
Yes. Does that have something to do with salaries now?
Yes, it does. No, we fond time serving.
Hey, there's an amendment. Sorry.
This committee is on today. You're witnessing. If the camera's not here, it's a little loose. Okay, Senator Elton is in the room. Do you want to give us an overview of what your experience was like on the commission? And then we do have Carl Kurtz on the line from the National Conference of State Legislatures to tell us a little bit about the perspective nationwide. Senator Elton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Senator Kim Elton, representing District B in the Senate. It feels odd to say this when I've said it now. This is the second time in a few weeks. I'm not here in my capacity as a senator. I'm here, believe it or not, more as an expert witness. And to speak about, this is a tough committee. I wondered whether I should approach the chair or not, Madam Chair. I'm somewhat embarrassed to admit that I'm speaking to a circumstance that happened 30 years ago. And so this is really historical, and there may be some questions that you ask, and I'm just going to have to say I don't remember. with that qualification, I will speak a little bit about my experience as having served on a salary commission that was formed in the mid-1970s. And the impetus for that salary commission was an initiative that repealed a legislative act that raised salaries for legislators and that also created a very generous retirement system for legislators. The initiative passed to repeal both of those elements. The initiative passed by about 80%. And in the wake of that, the salary commission was created with members appointed by the governor. I don't remember if there were qualifications or something that would disqualify a person from serving on the committee. For example, this bill provides that nobody can be seated on the committee that has held one of the positions in the last 4 years. I don't recall what kind of conditions were there. I do recall that all of the members of the commission were from the private sector, were not from, did not hold a state job, and did not hold a municipal position, and did and weren't from the judicial branch. One of the problems that I think the commission faced, the historical salary commission faced, was the scope of the authorities of that commission. Unlike in this bill, that commission was authorized to review the salary of all elected officials, governor, lieutenant governor, legislators, all judges, commissioners, deputy commissioners, down to division directors. And that was it wasn't as burdensome, I think, on the commission to do all of those reviews, but I do think it created issues within the legislative branch when the recommendations were made. There were so many different recommendations that were made that it created an opportunity for so many legislators who disagreed with one element to be displeased with the recommendations. As the timeline provided by the sponsor notes, this commission lasted, I think, until 1980. Was disbanded, and subsequent attempts to kind of resurrect a salary commission have not been successful. I have tried very hard, Madam Chair, to not comment on what salary should be, and unless asked, I won't talk about that. But I do feel comfortable telling you that I think the notion behind a salary commission makes sense. And I think this notion is a better notion than the one we had in the mid-1970s because the review is narrower. And I think it will be easier for a report to be accepted that is narrower in scope. With that, I'll end there. Please don't ask me a question that requires me to think back 30 years and try to remember a specific thing. But I'm open to any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you, Senator Elton. Questions? Senator Green?
No.
Senator Stevens?
Or comments?
Just the issue of the ethical lapses that have occurred in this building, do you believe that a fair salary would have any impact on people's ethical actions?
Through the chair, I do. I don't know that I can quantify the extent to which that could happen. I think a greater impact is perhaps not on the ethics of the body, but maybe the demographics of the body. I'll use the chair as an example. I mean, if you look around the 60 members, most of them are old white guys like me, who have had a career, who have paid off our homes, who don't have kids at home. And I think that demographic is largely the result of how difficult it is for a younger person with kids at home, still making house payments, and faced with a decision on whether or not to serve on the fact that they take themselves out of the workforce, out of their profession. Their cohorts in that profession are moving ahead over the 4 or 6 or 8 years that they're gone. So I think the greater impact, I think there probably will be an impact, although you're now hearing my personal philosophy. I think that people who may be ethically challenged, it may not be an issue of what the salary is, but I do think it would have, I would hope that it would have a significant impact on the demographics of both the bodies.
Absolutely. Further questions? Senator French.
More along the way, lines of a comment. I think this bill is a very good idea. I think it's overdue. I hope the commission, the bill is doesn't really say how often the commission has to meet. It just says they have to meet at the call of the chair. They have to meet twice to discuss their findings. I don't see any other, you know, sort of laying out of, you know, whether they should meet once a month, twice a month, and so forth. I hope they review these hearings. I'm asking the commission sort of look at whether we truly do have a citizen legislature or not. I think we all sort of aspire to that. I think we want to think we have that. But I can only think of 2 or 3 individuals in this building who are able to maintain a successful business outside of it. Yeah. And most of us sort of gravitate, you know, the job sort of fills to expand the time you have for it. It's hard to do something else while you're doing this job. And you wind up becoming sort of a professional legislator over time. That's been my experience. As I move, you know, get more experience and learn more, you find there's more work to do and more that you can do. And so I guess I would ask the commission to sort of look at the 60 individuals who are serving now and figure out, you know, whether they're truly citizen legislators or whether they are professional legislators, you know, sort of de facto. And I think, you know, as much as we want to hold ourselves out as citizen legislators, it may not be the case that that's what we are.
Yeah. Senator Elton?
Madam Chair, I know that wasn't a question, if you'll allow me, I'd like to respond.
Yes.
I mean, I think it is an important question that was raised by Senator French. And there are entities out there that can help the commission quantify that question. Mm. And I would just commend to the committee's attention, if they're interested, National Conference on State Legislatures, I hope I've got NCSL, that's the way we know of them, has identified all of the different states, and they have assigned a color to those states based on the amount of time that is spent by a legislator. The brightest and color is red, and that's for full-time legislators. The next is white, and the next is blue, which is really a part-time legislature. NCSL has colored us dark pink, trending far more toward the red than the white. Mm-hmm. And so I think it should be relatively easy, and I'm sure there are other entities out there that have done the same thing, but I think I I think the commission could get that kind of information very easily to help make that determination without listening to us, but listening to entities from outside the state that have done that kind of work.
Great point. Senator Bundy.
I would have a similar question for Representative Dugan when he has a chance to return.
You want to come up, Representative Dugan? And then we'll go to Mr. Kurtz from NCSL.
Madam Chair, am I excused then to go back to finance?
You're excused.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Alton.
There's really no excuse, though, for yeah.
It is a tough committee. Welcome back, Representative Dugan.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that would be my question as to whether you conceive as this commission recommending, as Senator French has suggested, toward a full-time legislature, reminding ourselves, of course, that part-time legislature was established by the Constitution, and that would, of course, take a vote of the people to change that, and somehow there seems to be some inconsistency between the fervor for a 90-day session and the willingness of the public to support a full-time legislature.
Thank you, through the chair, Senator Bundy. It's a difficult question because, in fact, we are a citizen legislature. We're all still citizens. I think we have some of our rights as citizens left. And we're all professional legislators as well in the sense that we get paid to legislate. I mean, we don't get paid a lot, but, you know, it seems to me that the essential question is this a full-time legislature or a part-time legislature? And that is pretty easily quantifiable. You know, there are measures that can be made in terms of how many days out of the year we meet. If you counted year before last, that would have put us pretty high up on the charts. There are measures in terms of how many hours legislators work both in session and out of session. We have, you know, records of who's claimed what in terms of working. There are all of those things. It would be my hope that the commission would take a good hard look at those indicators of what's actually happening as opposed to what theory somebody or some group might hold about what it is we're doing, and make a recommendation based on sort of, you know, what's going on in the real world, which is kind of what we're looking for from any group we deal with, I think.
Senator Bundy?
Additional question is maybe just a semantic issue with me, but the notion of long-term per diem is one that has bugged me for a long time. Per diem for people who live in Juneau and receive a per diem, it flies in at least in my understanding, the definition of per diem, and would be interested in your reaction to changing that to simply to some other more appropriate term, you know, some kind of other salary issue or term that would describe it more accurately than a per diem. It's taxable. It's obviously not a per diem.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, it is difficult. I find it difficult myself in explaining to people the sort of what is involved in my compensation as a legislator to distinguish between the per diem that I'm paid for being in Juneau, which is per diem in the sense that most people would understand it, and this concept of long-term per diem, which I get paid even if I'm living in my house in Anchorage for whatever official duties it is I'm doing. And it would seem to me that were I to make a recommendation to this commission, which I think any of us would be free to do, the way that I understand this process would work, that I'd recommend that if we're going to have a stipend, if we're going to get paid for working outside the session and we're going to pay taxes on it anyway, you know, that we shouldn't be calling it something that nobody else in the world would call it.
Right.
You know, the IRS won't call it per diem. They tax you on it. So that it should be looked at more in terms of being part of our salary or compensation or whatever the right term would be there, rather than using that term long-term per diem. I'm afraid I don't know exactly where it came from or how it originated. I just know that when I'm sit down on somebody's porch talking about this stuff, it's you know, they always give me that look, you know, like your dog gives you when you can't figure out what you're talking about.
I my suspicion is it was back in those days where there was some kind of smoke and mirrors of saying it's not really salary, it's per diem, et cetera, et cetera. But it is indeed a stipend, and and as we figure our salaries, that stipend should be somehow figured into what the salary is, the long-term per diem and the general per diem for general legislators, for a little more truth in labeling.
Senator Green.
You know, I wonder if that doesn't go back to a time where for out-of-towners coming in. It's one thing for an Anchorage or a Fairbanks legislator who stays in Fairbanks or Anchorage all the time. But even for Senator Stevens or for me, when I head into town, you know, and go to meeting, it's different in that. And then he's, you know, flying. And it's just very different if you're going to the hotel or you're. And when my original district, which was from nearly to Glen Allen to Hurricane Gulch Bridge, mm-hmm. you know, I could start the day in Eureka and end up in Talkeetna. So yeah. you're traveling everywhere. So you need to take, say, a woman needs to take someone with her, so you buy their meals. And so it's and that's not all easy to claim. And I wouldn't think it was probably designed for urban legislators as much as maybe out-of-towners
or maybe yeah, they were and having yet, and yet you face and Representative Duke and I were discussing this the other day, you face this dilemma where you actually are working and mm-hmm. most people that claim long-term per diem will spend the whole day working on legislative mm-hmm. Stuff, and so if you don't take it, then what do you do? Mm-hmm. But if you do take it, how do you explain what long-term per diem is? I mean, we all know it's compensation for what you're doing, but right. the name ends up being odd. So I think, you know, hopefully this public record will be useful to the commission to consider. Mm-hmm. And I think Senator Green brings up a good point, which is also in terms of effective representation, folks that live outside of the highway system and how it is that their travel to and from and so forth is considered. I know that that there are some disparities in that. And the last thing I want to say, and Senator Stevens has something, and then let's hear from NCSL, is that I had considered a couple of years ago, and I don't know how possible this is, but there is great debate in this building about whether you have full-time or part-time legislatures, as you well know. And the folks that have retirements generally feel pretty strongly that this is something you do later in your life. It's a choice that you make, and you shouldn't be paid full time for it. The folks in my generation who do this, and as you know, I sit as a chair of a nationwide group and a vice chair, and I do those things because they bring Alaska in a good light. They help bring Alaska information. They bring information from me back to our state. I love to do my job, and I don't really know how to do it part time most of the time. So for the folks that are in their earning years, I think it's important that their voice is heard in this building, particularly when you're talking about those things that impact earning years decisions. Mm-hmm. I also think there's a gender thing that comes into play that you referenced a little bit, and that's you know, the idea of getting some more women in the building too, and I just want to put that on the record. But the thought that I had, and it's just something to consider, would be that you get an option when you choose to serve or even to file, that you will choose to run as a part-time or a full-time lawmaker. And I can see arguments on both if you are a member of the public voting. I mean, in some cases, your district may say, we would like someone who's going to be right out front. They're going to be full-time. This is what they're going to do. I think some of the benefits would be one, you know, the one master concept. You're there full time to at our service, but we're going to expect you to be there full time as well. So none of this, well, it's Thursday and you're off doing your other job thing. I mean, you're full time. On the other hand, there may be a district that says we would like a part time lawmaker because we feel that the concept of, you know, part time lawmaking is relevant and important. I don't know whether that there's a way to do it or not, but what I would be interested is just let's start calling a spade a spade, because I think so much of what you see, Senator Stevens has alluded to parts of it and so forth, is that, you know, we're moving things and pieces around and we're not being really direct about the amount of work that's done, what we're paid for it, and how that ought to work. So,
if I might, Madam Chair, I think particularly the question of sort of the generational disparity, if you will, in the legislature is a matter of, I think that people, and there's something in your packet that shows you that there really is a people in my age group, you know, I'm about to turn 60, are vastly overrepresented in the legislature in comparison to their representation in the general population. And people in their 20s, 30s, and even 40s are vastly underrepresented. I think that's in large part the question of whether or not younger people see an opportunity to do this in terms of what they're doing in the rest of their lives. And I'll just give you one example. We were all, I think, happily surprised with the participation of people in the caucuses here earlier this month. And that was in large part, I think, caused by the fact that people thought they'd actually be able to make a difference there, you know, that they had an opportunity to make a difference. And I think that if more people saw this as an opportunity to do their public service while not essentially having to abandon their private lives, then that there's a possibility that we'd get more options come election time.
And I don't think that anyone that I've ever spoken with believes that being a lawmaker should be a lucrative, profitable, it is public service.
Right.
And you are making a choice in doing it to serve. But I think that the question is just sort of, is there a basic level of life where you can pay your bills and your mortgage and so forth that ought to be expected or not? And,
right.
And it's an interesting question about how you want to have a representative democracy. Senator Bundy, and Senator Stevens actually was ahead of you.
Oh,
my apologies.
Ahead.
Senator Stevens.
Well, I was going to wax eloquent for some time here, but I thought
too late.
we are coming to an end here, and I would like to hear Mr. Kurtz. So what's
yes.
our time frame here? Do we have, how much time do we have?
I'm going to have to step out.
But okay, so why don't we do this? We could put the pause button on our comments, listen to Mr. Kurtz, and then bring this back up next week. And Mr. Kurtz, if you want to go ahead, I will. How long is your testimony? He's not. So what we'll do is listen to waxing eloquent, yeah. waxing philosophic, and then we'll wrap up at 10:30 and have Mr. Kurtz come back.
Sure.
Tuesday.
Mr. Eloquent.
That'll
okay.
be fine.
Okay.
You bet.
Senator Stevens.
Well, maybe I've set up exhortations. Not going to be reached, but you know, I mean, I really like the idea of a citizen legislature. Just philosophically, I think it's a great thing, that a citizen legislature. But when you compare that to a professional legislature, you realize that. And you talked about when you ran, what you anticipated if you decide you wanted to be part-time or full-time. You know, I thought this was not going to be quite as involving as it is. I mean, I had no idea that I would go home and go to the office almost every day with some issue that somebody wanted to talk to me about. So it's probably not full-time, but it certainly isn't part-time. So I guess that whole issue of being a citizen legislature, you know, the fact legislator that you come from the people, you come from your community, you're sent to Juneau, and then you go back home after it's over. Maybe before you expected to go back home, you know, you're drawn back. I think the definition of a citizen legislator versus a professional legislator is how much you get paid.
Yeah.
That's the definition, you know. Right. And if we pay legislators in Alaska more, we'll be professional too. So I think that it's just a term that has to do with how much we give our legislators. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Senator Bundy.
Look forward to Mr. Kurtz.
Yeah, and it's just it's adding, I feel like a member of the Fish Board. I'll add my view from my little segment of reality. We talk about full and part-time, and I think often in the public members view us sort of like the fire department. Doesn't matter if we're there unless they need us, and then we better be there and be there right now. Mm-hmm. And so we have a part-time legislature by definition now, unless someone's got a problem, and then we're expected to be full-time.
Yeah.
And that dichotomy in the public's view is going to be very difficult to change. I could just see people setting themselves up to run for election. Elect me, I promise to work full-time. And I said, get out of here. We don't want that. I only want you full-time when I need you. I don't care what my neighbor thinks. Yeah. And or probably would maybe it even be worse. Like me, I don't plan to work very much at all. I'm getting back to, you know, it's a constitutional establishment of, which is, you know, held a, our Constitution held in great esteem by many, many Alaskans. And this commission will be an education commission as much as anything. Mm. And they've got a lot of information to share and with some folks that often aren't very interested. It's sort of like teaching.
Actually, it's a great analogy.
Madam Chair, if I might, just to amplify that point, I had a fella call me up, you know, when I was running for election. I just gave out my cell phone address to everybody, and it rang one day. And it was an older fella who'd been to my office that day to see me and wanted to know why I wasn't there. And I said to him, well, did you make an appointment? He said, no. He said, I thought I'd just drop by and talk to you. And I said, well, you know, you don't have a full-time legislature. And he said, oh, I don't want you to be there full-time, just when I come to see you.
That's a great, that is, yes, excellent. Thank you very much, Representative Dugan, and we will hear from Mr. Kurtz. We look forward to his presentation, and we'll just focus on that when we bring it back up.
Great.
Appreciate you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Okay, and we're adjourned.